You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. An initiative that would raise money to support housing in Astoria by taxing houses that are kept vacant for most of the year is moving forward. Katie Frankowitz reports.
This week, the group behind the initiative announced they had landed the more than 1,000 signatures from Astoria voters required to get an airing in front of the city council and potentially land the initiative on the November ballot. The initiative aims to target homes that the petitioners argue could have gone to long-term housing, but are instead left purposely vacant for much of the year. They estimate a tax on these vacant homes could generate nearly $1 million in revenue in its first year. That revenue would be put into a community housing fund overseen by city leaders. Petitioners say the money could support construction and preservation of affordable and workforce housing, provide rental and homebuyer assistance, and go toward housing-related infrastructure and tenant services. Andy Kipp is one of the chief petitioners.
Any type of new tax, I think, is concerning to certain segments of the population. Other people we spoke to recognize that, you know, if you're living in your home full-time, if you're renting it out, if you're fixing it up, you know, those people would not be taxed at all. For most people in Astoria who support the measure, they recognize that the housing shortage is not something that's going to be just sort of fixed on its own, and we really have to come together as a community to think about creative solutions.
The Astoria City Council will consider the petition at its August 3rd meeting. Councilors will have several options to choose from. They could adopt the petition and proceed through the city's standard ordinance adoption process. They could reject the petition, in which case it would be referred to the November ballot for voters to make the decision. Or they could reject the petition and propose alternative language. In that case, both the original initiative and the city-sponsored version would go on the November ballot. The City Council could also consider the petition over multiple meetings, but a final decision needs to be made before September 3rd, the deadline for submitting measures for the upcoming election. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting.
Tillamook City Council addressed long-standing downtown parking issues at a recent meeting. City leadership unanimously approved amendments to the city ordinances that would ban the storage of recreational vehicles on city streets and limit parking for cars to 72 hours. City Manager Sean Lewis says this will give the police department a better set of tools to address issues with people living in their vehicles. The update includes a provision that bans sleeping in cars in the public right-of-way. City staff developed a framework for a new downtown parking plan that includes reserved parking for employees of downtown businesses and permit fees to pay for more robust parking enforcement. A second public hearing on the amendments will be held at the council's next meeting on August 3rd. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. Researchers have begun redeveloping ocean monitoring equipment after it was yanked from the Northwest waters by the Trump administration. But it could be months before all the equipment sitting in a warehouse in Corvallis, Oregon, goes to sea again. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
Researchers at Oregon State University this month sent two underwater vehicles called gliders back out to sea. They look like yellow torpedoes, about 6 feet long. One of them will monitor rising ocean temperatures and sagging oxygen levels off the Oregon coast. One will monitor Washington waters. The larger observatories that the Trump administration quietly removed last September will take longer to put back. In June, the administration ended its push to dismantle observatories off the West and East coasts after widespread criticism. The Oregon researchers hope to deploy two floating observatories in October. Four more are to be back in place next spring. Their temporary removal has left a permanent gap in the long-term data used to understand phenomena like climate change and El Nino. I'm John Ryan reporting.
A series of lightning storms across Oregon have left a trail of wildfires, causing firefighters and communities to race to contain them. Roughly 1.5 million acres have burned so far, more than four times last year's total. Monica Carrillo-Casas reports.
For communities in Oregon, this wildfire season is bringing a new level of challenges and uncertainty as 32 large fires remain uncontained. Homes and structures have burned across the state, including in Crook County and on the Warm Springs Reservation in Central Oregon. Oregon Department of Forestry's Public Information Officer Jessica Newyear says more than 12,000 personnel are working to contain fires.
It's really rare to see this many acres burn this early, and we still have August and September left.
At least 32,000 people in Oregon are under some level of evacuation order. Forecasters expect another round of lightning storms later this week in the northeastern part of the state. I'm Monica Carrillo Casas, reporting.
The Oregon Health Authority is asking Lower Umatilla Basin residents to test their wells for nitrates again. Antonio Sierra has more.
Nitrates have been a known problem in Umatilla and Morrow counties for decades. Consuming significant amounts of nitrates has been linked to a number of diseases, including cancer. OHA officials say nitrate levels tend to increase during the summer, meaning a follow-up test could reveal unsafe water. Saida Guzman lives south of Boardman and draws her drinking water from a well. She says she's never trusted her well's water, and a new test is unlikely to change that.
Regardless of what the numbers say, I'm not drinking the water.
OHA says only about one-third of households who have tested for nitrates have done so more than once. Public health officials plan to canvass the basin to encourage retests next month. Antonio Sierra, OPB. Antonio Sierra, reporting.
Douglas County commissioners passed a resolution last week saying they are not a sanctuary county and they support the Trump administration's immigration policy. Now they're doubling down, saying the resolution was legal and followed public meeting law, but backlash has rippled across the state. KLCC's Rebecca Hansen-White reports.
Douglas County commissioners know some organizations are considering legal action, but they argue, quote, disagreement with a public resolution does not change the legal process that was followed. Oregon's largest farm worker advocacy group is among those condemning the resolution. Meanwhile, the Oregon BIPOC caucus called the vote unconscionable and said they were monitoring the situation for potential legislative solutions. Opponents also worry about potential violations of Oregon's Sanctuary Promise Act, which bars local governments from helping with immigration enforcement without a judicial warrant. I'm Rebecca Hansen-White, reporting.
Curry County commissioners have accused the sheriff's office of spending undisclosed donations on a jet ski, grill, and retirement party. As Jefferson Public Radio's Justin Higginbottom reports, they claim the purchases were for private gain.
The county government alleges Sheriff John Ward and former Sheriff John Bishop accepted nearly $400,000 from a local nonprofit. Commissioners say none of that money was reported to the county. Instead, the department bought vehicles, watercraft, and a storage shed put on Ward's property, among other purchases. The county, which posted receipts to Facebook, says more than $90,000 in donations is unaccounted for. In a statement, Commissioner Jay Trost called it corruption. Ward was not available for comment. It's unclear to what extent his department used the purchases for police work. Commissioners say they have shared evidence with the county district attorney and state ethics board. I'm Justin Higginbottom in Ashland.
Roseburg will look at potentially creating two urban playgrounds on parking lots downtown. Jefferson Public Radio's Jane Vaughn reports.
Staff will bring back more details about the two city-owned lots at a future meeting. The goal is to help address the city's homelessness crisis. At a Monday meeting, staff estimated the city is currently spending about $114,000 a month on homelessness-related issues, which includes law enforcement and public works. Councillor Zach Weiss said that even doing nothing to address the problem has a price.
This is costing us, whether it's costing us the money or it's costing us the resources that are dedicated to the community, it is costing us one way or another.
Roseburg has previously considered and rejected multiple sites for an urban campground, including canceling a deal to buy property meant for that purpose. One issue with the latest proposed lots is Umpqua Community College is relying on that parking for a planned housing development. I'm Jane Vaughn reporting.
An old landfill on the Key Peninsula will be the site of a new solar energy project in Pierce County. NWPB's Lauren Gallup takes us there.
The ground is domed with brown grass, dry from the summer sun. Below layers of soil, clay, and plastic liners are tons of decomposing waste. This landfill in Purdy closed in 1989.
The question for us was, what do we want to do about the closed landfill.
That's Ryan Dix. He's a sustainability manager and solid waste administrator for the county. Now, there's not much that can be done with old landfills, but some people have found a solution. Communities across the U.S. are turning these sites into solar arrays. Pierce County is using this property for that.
Finding this large of an area that isn't fully treated is really rare in Western Washington, and so that's why it made really great sense to go with a solar project.
On top of the closed landfill, there are now over 1,000 solar panels. Once they're up and running,
we believe that this 1 megawatt solar project is going to create enough energy to run 100 homes for the entire year.
The county says it thinks the site will start collecting energy by the end of the year. In Purdy, I'm Lauren Gallup.
After months of closed-door talks, Portland City Councilors will hold a public meeting Thursday to hash out how to spend public money on the city's aging NBA arena. Last week, OPB's Alex Zielinski talked with key city officials who've been at the negotiating table. They answered some of the most pressing questions Portlanders have ahead of this week's meeting.
Earlier this year, the Oregon legislature pledged to put $365 million toward renovating the Moda Center. That is, if the Blazers agree to a 20-year lease and if Multnomah County and Portland also pitch in money. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson agreed to hand over $120 million. But City Council has to sign off on that plan and set the terms for negotiating the Blazers' new lease on the arena, which the city owns. City officials say the Blazers haven't made it easy.
They don't want to engage. And so at any moment that they're asked to, that's their reaction. It's very, you know, adversarial. It isn't in good faith and trying to get to a place of compromise.
That's Donnie Oliveira. He's a deputy city administrator who oversees city facilities like the Moda Center. He's been involved with negotiations from the beginning. He said the city has been asking the Blazers for details on proposed arena renovations for months and gotten little in return. But the city doesn't have much time to wait. City leaders want to finalize the deal by the end of the year. The state says it needs a lease in hand by then to be able to issue bonds next year.
So there's still a huge gap of information that's going to be required by December. So it's not just the burden on the city to take an action. It's also on the Blazers to provide us with the information to even validate those decisions.
A Blazers representative told OPB they have been transparent with the city and are waiting for the city to share information with them about where the money's coming from. But the city says they can't give that information until they get more answers from the Blazers. At the same time, the team says they see City Council as the barrier to meeting that deadline. City councilors have raised questions and concerns about the deal. It's not certain they'll even approve the basic framework of negotiations at an August 12th council meeting.
So just the more we delay, the more burden it puts on our negotiating and legal teams to crank this out.
So what happens if the city and the Blazers miss the December deadline to finalize the lease?
I think we have no choice but to go back to the state.
That's City Administrator Raymond Lee. He said that the state legislature will need to vote again to approve the promised millions in bonds if the deal isn't wrapped in time. And they might not approve it again.
I don't think the state is going to be a happy camper in that situation.
To get the deal back on track, Lee is looking to another group to help, the 30-person NBA Board of Governors.
Whatever deal is finalized between ourselves, the state, the Blazers, the NBA as an association has to approve that. So I think a lot of our conversations thus far has been around what does a deal look like to the NBA as well.
He's hopeful their support can help avoid the worst-case scenario, the deal falling through, and the possibility that Blazers' new owner, Tom Dundon, will move the team to another city. Oliveira said if that happens, the blow would be felt across Portland.
Being branded as an NBA city means something. So while the arena isn't going to go mothballed, let's just be clear, I know that gets brought up, over time, we're just going to probably see ourselves not as dynamic or attractive because we aren't attached to that brand.
And the city would still be on the hook to maintain its aging arena that's home to Portland's WNBA team and the city's main venue for big artists and events. But it wouldn't have any state money to help. This is Alex Zielinski reporting.
You
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN, turning now to news out of Washington State. Charges have been filed against the teenager accused of being one of the Seattle Center shooters. The young male is charged with first-degree assault with an enhanced firearm and unlawful possession of a firearm in the second degree. KNKX's Mitch Borden reports.
The 15-year-old suspect was arrested by police on Sunday after a gunfight broke out at Seattle Center during the food festival Bite of Seattle. Three people were killed and at least four were injured. One of the deceased, a 19-year-old man, is believed to have been involved with the shooting, according to the Seattle Police Department. Officials say the shooting may have been gang-related and are searching for at least one other suspect. King County prosecutors are requesting the 15-year-old be tried as an adult. This will be determined by a judge, but it could take several months before a decision is made. I'm Mitch Borden, reporting.
A proposed wind project on Washington's Palouse has raised various concerns, but now it's drawing support from some Nez Perce tribal members. NWPB's senior environmental correspondent Courtney Flatt has the story.
The Harvest Hills Wind Project would add 45 wind turbines to private agricultural land in Whitman County. But people raised enough concerns about landscape views and wildlife that the county adopted strict rules for commercial wind projects. Now, developers are going through a state process that overrides county rules. And NMEPU Protecting the Environment has stepped in to show its support. Julian Matthews heads up the environmental nonprofit run by Nez Perce tribal members. The project would be built on the Nez Perce's ancestral lands.
We have to have alternative energy sources, whether it's wind or solar.
Matthews says his group doesn't automatically support all wind projects, but he says responsibly sited projects are needed to help slow climate change and to reduce dependence on hydropower. I'm Courtney Flatt.
Washington voters are casting their ballots for the August 4th primary election. The state's open primary system advances the top two candidates to the general election, regardless of party. As state government reporter Sarah Mises-Tan reports, there are a number of competitive races.
We'll definitely be watching the 3rd Congressional District. In the 4th Congressional District, arguably one of the most reliably red districts that covers central Washington, there are 11 candidates vying for that seat, with the top fundraisers so far being Republicans. Amanda McKinney is the frontrunner here with an endorsement from President Trump.
The primary could be a bellwether to see if more voters go blue this midterm election cycle. You're listening to KMUN.
Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN news team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next, followed by the Ship Report with Joanne Rideout. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A second appeals court handed down a ruling on President Trump's March 31st executive order on elections, this time allowing the U.S. Postal Service's preparations for checking eligibility of mail-in voters to proceed, the opposite of a different court's July 25th ruling. What gives? Yesterday, we reported on a Trump administration appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. A First Circuit appeals court upheld a block of the president's directive to USPS to create a state citizenship list to verify voters receiving or returning mail-in ballots. Attorneys general from 23 states argued successfully it violated the Elections Clause, and states had already been harmed because election officials expended resources to prevent the election chaos the executive order is likely to create. Then July 28, the U.S. Appeals Court for D.C. upheld a ruling favoring the president, this time a challenge from a pro-voter coalition and Democratic groups. The coalition failed to convince either the federal district or appeals courts. Both ruled that voters had not yet been harmed because the unimplemented policy had not yet broken any laws. There's no word on whether the two cases will be combined, but it's increasingly likely the U.S. Supreme Court will need to settle the dispute. We've linked the July 28th and previous decisions at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal. Find us at Blue Sky at Democracy Minute.